Hello, and welcome to your free therapy session. My name is Hole.
My name is Ryan, and this is Therapy Hour.
Because everyone needs therapy.
But not everyone can afford it.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam peoples. Well, everyone, as you may notice, we have a different voice in the studio today. While Violet is away on vacation, we decided to bring on Ryan, which is he's a third-year psych student doing a self-directed seminar on the psychology of love. Very happy to have you today.
I'm really happy to be here.
Okay, so I would love if you could tell everyone a little bit about what your course is on, and maybe let's start with why you decided to start the seminar.
Okay, yeah. So it's going to be a student-directed seminar here at UBC. And in all honesty, this psychology of love course really came from last year when I had my first relationship ever. And that brought it with it my first ever breakup, which was like relatively fine and normal. But I was trying to make sense of it in the most, like, psychology major, nerdy kid type of way. Like, you know, what better way to deal with a breakup with your feelings than putting them all in a seminar?
Right.
So me and my roommate decided that why don't we go and investigate a topic like love and, like, run our own course, because that's something you can do. And, you know, I wanted to really understand why I felt things so intensely with the breakup and about the particular person. And I really wanted to understand, like, why and where it came from.
Yeah.
And, you know, I threw myself over summer into learning about the psychology behind love and attraction. And I was trying to, like, find an answer and make sense and sort of rationalize why I was feeling the way I was feeling.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, human relationships have always fascinated me. I think it's so amazing that we have an innate capacity to, like, love things, other people, family, friends, objects. And also, like, why we feel that certain love to some individuals and not others.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of where it came from.
Well, I love that you said that, because we talked about this a little bit earlier. And, like, I think one similarity we both have is that we do analyze our feelings. And, like, I think that in some ways doing it in an academic sense kind of feels like you can cope a little bit better, because, you know, feelings are really difficult and they're really hard to process. So it kind of helps in a way. Like, I would love to know a little bit about, like, for you, how you felt that, like, looking at it from an academic lens, like, helped you cope maybe a little bit better than you would if you were just kind of, like, in your feelings the entire time.
Yeah, yeah. So, like you said, someone like me, who at the time, I was not used to feeling all these intense emotions. Like, I really did not know what to do with them. It was, can be really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And frankly, really scary to not have control, like, over your feelings. Like, you're thinking about this, you're sad about this the whole day, and you're sort of, like, lost at sea, and you kind of want something to ground yourself on and to hold on to. So definitely it was a way for me to, like, make sense of what was going on in my head.
Yeah.
And I think for me, especially rationalizing something at the time, which I felt like my emotions were a little bit irrational.
Yeah.
You know? I was like, okay, I had a breakup, like, normal. Why do I feel so sad?
Of course.
What was it about this person or about this thing? And I really wanted answers in the hope that once I got them, like, I could make sense of it, rationalize it, like, logic it, and then everything would be okay. It sort of became like this battle in my head between the logical side of my brain and then the more, like, feeling and emotional side of my brain. And that was starting to really grow as a result of having to deal with all these feelings. And I think as psych majors, you might resonate with this. It's like answering questions and, like, solving these type of problems. It's what we're used to doing. And especially as we learn about, like, human emotions, you automatically think that, okay, I feel this, I need to know why, I need to know what's happening. Like, you have this need to answer
the
question.
Yeah, because you kind of feel like there's no, like, you know that the feeling is unsettling and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So you're like, well, there must be a reason for this.
Exactly.
And you get this nice little project at the end of it, which is kind of nice. So I know that you haven't actually done the seminar yet, but I was wondering if, like, now that you've kind of set it up a little bit, how has that affected your kind of, like, process throughout this, like, breakup of yours?
I think one of the biggest things, amongst, like, a lot of other factors that obviously help you get over it in time and whatnot, but having this as a source of, like, meaning or purpose or something, like a goal to work towards, it was a way for me to formulate, like, like a learning experience. I think, and this might be an unhealthy habit, is that every time something you go through something uncomfortable, I want to get the learning out of it.
Like,
you know, I'm not used to just sitting with my feelings, as you might be able to tell. I want to get something out of it. I want to learn and maximize the learning I can.
Yeah.
And, you know, this course, I think just diving into the fact that this is a very human condition. Breakups are very human. Like liking someone so intensely. I'm not the only one in the world doing this and going through it and seeing that. And seeing how it's like a very common thing, and I'm able to then talk about it and explain it to myself and to people around me, I think it gave me a good balance to deal with those emotions and feelings and also like sort of process them and output them in a reasonably productive manner.
Yeah, like I love what you said about how there's almost this moment of like not maybe wanting to, you know, over-intellectualize the feelings, but I do love that, like, you were able to have this project which kind of forced you to talk more about this. Like, it forced you to think more about what you were feeling. And yes, you could think about it in this really intellectual way, but you could also think about it in a way of like, okay, well, now I get to talk about this more, and now I can maybe get through these feelings a little bit more.
Yeah, it forces you to, I think, also reckon with these feelings a little bit instead of maybe just sitting back and letting them take you, you know, away. It's like you're forced to deal with them a little bit more than if not.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking a lot about breakups, but I wanted to have the listeners know kind of where you were coming from.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick little break because then we're going to dive into the really, really cool stuff. Ryan's going to take over my job this week and he's going to explain some research that went into building this seminar. We're going to be talking about attraction, the act of falling, and more. And in the meantime, we're going to listen to a little song called Love's Train by Silk Sonic. This was Ryan's suggestion, which I'm very grateful for. We're going to be right back after that and some ads. You won't want to miss it.
Dead coming to the Imperial May 6th to support their newest single, Bad Love, out now from their recently announced brand new album, Blue Skies. Available wherever you listen to music, May 27th.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
And we're back. You're listening to Therapy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM. We're here with Ron, and he's going to tell us a little bit about the contents of this seminar he's going to run in the next year. I'm going to say that for the first question, I would love to know a little bit about, from your perspective and maybe from the psychological perspective, what do you think love is? Which is a big question,
big,
I know.
Big question.
But I feel like you're probably the best person to ask at this point.
Well, yeah. Million-dollar question that we're trying to answer in this course, and that researchers, poets, artists, scientists have all been trying to answer for decades now.
Yeah.
I think love is so vast and can encompass so many different things for different people. You know, it means a lot of different things for different people. So I'd like to say that, like, straight off the bat.
Yeah.
But there are a few key commonalities across people when it comes to love from a psychological perspective.
Mm-hmm.
There's one definition I really resonated with from Dr. Carrie Jenkins, who's actually a philosophy professor here at UBC. In her book on love, she says that romantic love sort of has a dual nature. It's ancient biological machinery embodying a modern social role. And that we're right to say that romantic love, or certain aspects of it and the way we conceptualize it in society today, is a social or cultural construct. But at the same time, it's also a biological phenomenon. You know, it's like magical emotions. You could describe it as feelings. But the thing about feelings is they are fluid and change. If, say, someone's in love, they will have a very different conceptualization of what love means to them versus someone who's just recently been broken up with. And so it's, some researchers try to describe it as a set of behaviors associated with these feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But again, actions of love are very subjective and culturally relevant. You know, they're different across different cultures and time periods. Love has also been conceptually classified as a permanent or temporary addiction. A positive one.
Yeah.
There is research, which we'll get into later, comparing the neural pathways that love has on the brain are almost the same as those on people with drugs.
Wow.
There's also people who say that love is nature's, biology's way of sort of furthering our species through pair bonding and successful reproduction.
Right.
And sort of we're like biologically programmed to have that with us to further our species.
Mm-hmm.
But see, for me, is like, I don't know. Is that what love is? I feel like that's that pigeonholes it a bit. It's not
right.
All of these definitions are, I like to call it, one slice of the pie of all of what love means. And you know, I think love can love is definitely something that's constructed, but it's constructed from the reality of all these different things.
Yeah.
And it can be viewed from these lens in combination with them, from your experiences, your brain chemistry, evolutionary biology, your feelings, your cultural and societal expectations. I think it's a combination of all these things that really capture, or even maybe not. We're still struggling to define it, and I think actually that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's so interesting because a lot of what we talk about on this podcast, and a lot of what I talk about as someone who really loves psych, is that we don't have a lot of these definitions. Mm-hmm. We don't really know a lot of what we are talking about. Psych focuses so much on small aspects mm-hmm. of what we can isolate and what we can mm-hmm. define. But a lot of the times that's not the whole picture. Yeah. And it's funny because simultaneously people are trying to figure out, like, humans love definitions. We love yep. categories. We want to yeah. quantify yeah. like what this thing is. But it's really difficult. It's really hard. Exactly. But I think we can, like, I think what will be interesting this, you know, research section is that we can talk about aspects and explain things to the listeners, because I think that a lot of science that has been done on like different levels of love are highly interesting yep. and like really fascinating, especially the things you're talking about with addiction and stuff.
Yeah.
But let's jump into a few aspects of your course. Mm-hmm. So we were talking beforehand about how we wanted to talk about attraction. Mm-hmm. So can we talk a little bit about what attraction is on some frame of psychological level?
Yeah. So this one's interesting. This is something that's sparked my interest since I was in high school. Like, what makes me attracted to a few select people and not other people? And
yeah.
what researchers have shown, I'm specifically going to cite this book by Viren Swamy, who's a social psychologist in Anglia Ruskin University in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. There are around 4 to 5 things that make you more likely to be attracted to someone else. And the first thing is proximity. You know, you're going to more likely to like someone who might be obvious, who's closer to you, who lives yeah. in your neighborhood, goes to your school, attends the same university to you.
Right.
I think like dating apps nowadays have really, really, you know, like the radius you have.
Yeah, it's really challenged that.
Right. It's completely made it open it up so that you can be attracted to a whole range of people from around the world. But proximity still matters, because it's about how efficient and how you don't want to be spending a lot of time and energy, you know, going after to get to know someone. You're more likely to form relationships with people close to you.
Right.
And then there's also this thing called the mere exposure effect, where any stimuli, and we'll take the example of a person.
Yeah.
Just the mere fact of being exposed to that person more frequently,
yeah.
and you will end up rating them more positively on a scale of attraction. You'll end up actually being yeah. more attracted to them, and they don't have to do anything. Just the mere fact of you seeing them more often.
Yeah.
So that's where proximity plays a big role.
Yeah.
The second thing is physical appearance. Physical appearance does play a big factor in who you tend to find attractive or yeah. not.
Which people love to question.
Exactly.
But, like, I find it so interesting when people are like, oh, like, you can like anyone. And it's true
yeah.
in a lot of ways. But yeah. I do think that people forget that we are sometimes, you know, the visual and physical aspect is important for lots
yeah.
of people.
Yeah. It's nice to say, like, I will agree that yeah, it's a lot more than falling in love with someone is a lot more than just the way they look like. But as a starting point, you're going to have to be physically attracted to
yeah.
someone to initiate all of that. In fact, research shows that once you've socially interacted with someone, suddenly the physical appearance starts to dip in importance. All the other personality factors start to play. But to get you to have that social interaction,
right.
how people look like matters.
Yeah.
And it matters across the sexes for both males and females. There was some research done by Liu and Zhang in 2009, and they looked at speed dating.
Yeah.
And across the board, it was the biggest predictor of attraction was physical attractiveness. And we do, as human beings, tend to display an inherent beauty bias.
Yes.
Something called the halo effect, where we tend to more associate more positive ratings of anything like job status, friendly sociability with people who we perceive as more attractive, even if it might not be true.
Right.
So that does play a big part.
Very cool.
Another thing is reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
We prefer people who make us feel good and make us feel like appreciated. And we then tend to feel like we need to give something back to them as well. Now, this reciprocity thing only continues to play a big role in attraction if it's equal and both parties' interactions are sort of mutually beneficial. You know,
right.
if I'm giving 50%, you're giving 50% back.
Mm-hmm.
It starts to go be less important if I'm giving 60% and the other person I like is giving me 10%. Then I'm
right.
Not likely to be, you know, continue my attraction for them. So reciprocity plays a big thing.
Yeah.
I like to group the next two into one: similarity and familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
They're a bit different. Similarity is more that research tends to show that we're most attracted to people who are like us in terms of our religious and political beliefs, values, mm-hmm. Even our appearance. We yeah. tend to date people who sort of are as attractive as us.
Yes, I remember learning about this.
There's been some research done on that. You sort of like, you know, you sort of tend to date people who look sort of in the same kind of bracket as you.
Yeah.
And then age and other demographic variables. There's popular saying that, you know, like opposites attract. And that's something right. I used to think as well. I used to think that, oh, I'm totally going to be into someone who's completely different from me because that's exciting. And to some extent, yes. Research shows that short-term relationships, it's great there, you know, but they tend to always fizzle out. And when yeah. you're looking for a long-term partner, it's mostly you want to have someone, you'll be attracted to someone more who's similar, at least in values and those bigger abstract things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense because I think when you kind of put these five aspects together, yeah. you know, I'm listening to you and it's like, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. I would yeah. obviously be attracted to yeah. someone who has these qualities. But it's so interesting because in a lot of ways, it does kind of feel like once in a blue moon or mm-hmm. like whatever, where you just like run past someone, you're like, oh, wow, like that person's so attractive. Yeah. So it's really interesting when you really start breaking it down as to what like actually goes into this type of attraction.
Totally. Yeah. And now those are some things that social psychologists have come up with, but there's yeah. a whole other faction of attraction that people have looked like from a more neurochemical and evolutionary psychology lens.
Cool.
One of the big names in this research is David Buss. He did a lot of studies in the 80s and the 90s. Really great studies. They were translated into 33 different languages across 33 different countries, and he found similar results across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And these are more factors that operate on a more unconscious level. So, for example, there's something like women prefer men who have maybe a deep voice because this is indicative of testosterone levels in a man.
Oh.
And testosterone levels, higher testosterone levels are associated with more like climbing social ladders more easily and also obtaining more resources. But when I'm going to list these examples of evolutionary like psychology and biology, I want you and the listeners to keep in mind that no one's actually, these are all like subconscious processes. No
yes.
one's coming out and saying, I really like his deep, sexy voice and I know he has more testosterone.
Right.
So he's going to secure resources for me and my kids. Like that's not how we think. That's
exactly.
But David Buss wanted to focus on like what were like qualities, physical and personality qualities that universally as human beings, could we find any universal ones? And what he found is that because he put forward that because men can father nearly an unlimited number of children,
mm-hmm.
They seem to favor signs of fertility in women, which come across as being young, attractive, and healthy. And on average, men tend to rate physical features is more important than the other things.
Yeah.
And then in contrast, he found that women favor a more selective mating strategy, given that there's a lot of time investment and resource investment in having a child. And
mm-hmm.
she can only look after a limited number of children during her life.
Mm-hmm.
So he proposed that women, and this is all heterosexual, let me point that out.
These are
studies conducted on just heterosexual people.
Yeah.
So that's another big problem with this research. But she looks for a man who is more financially stable, can provide for her children. Now, I would like to, it's not necessarily financials, it's resources. So resources can look different in different cultures where someone might have more food or more housing or a better job. It can come, culturally it can vary,
yeah.
but it's that underlying resource having that makes someone attractive.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's sort of what he found. And there's some really interesting other studies that have found, for example, attraction, it seems to be a combination of like chemical processes and evolutionary biology.
Yeah.
There's this thing called the Wedekind T-shirt study, which I learned about in high school. It's basically they gave participants who were all women, different age ranges, but they had different T-shirts to smell and sort of, they had guys wear t-shirts for a few days without showering, like you know, getting the whole day.
Yeah, I think I've heard this.
It's like the smelly t-shirt study. But what they found was that they had women smell the t-shirts and then sort of like rate who they found as more attractive just based on that smell. And they correlated those answers with the man's makeup of his MHC. So MHC, MHC is, I forget the what it stands for, but it's this thing in your nose that certain mammals, certain species have. And it's contested if humans have this or not. There's some evidence to say we do. Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of evidence saying we don't. And I don't know, like pheromones research, which is like smells and olfactory signals, is a very contested thing in psychology. We haven't actually found super hard evidence that suggests they're there, but we also don't know if they're not.
Exactly. But
anyways, they found that the women were able to rate people who were more attractive. It correlated with how not similar the MHC was for them. So they would choose a partner who had a completely different MHC. And this plays a role in an immunity function. And so you would want to mate with a partner who has a completely opposite immunity makeup to you, because that would make your child have the best of both and sort of have the most successful immunity complex. And they were able to just find that, you know, it was really surprising. They just found that was just a biological process that they just found. So there is a ton of research out there in the evolutionary field that sort of, I would say, pigeonholes attraction into very,
right,
this is what it is because of evolution. You know?
Right.
It doesn't really take into account like social or cultural parameters that much, or, you know, societal expectations. But
yeah.
I think it's a great foundation. You know, I think it's really interesting and it's very useful to take into account when we talk about who we select as mates or who we decide to, you know, maintain long-term relationships with.
Yeah, well, on the note of evolutionary psychology, I think it is a fascinating mm-hmm. way of thinking about psych.
Mm-hmm.
And we obviously talk about it a lot here, but I would love to know a little bit more about if you think, like you did kind of breach that topic
yeah.
of it's not 100% fully
yeah.
fleshed out.
Yeah.
And I always feel like we would always do better looking at it at a holistic
exactly.
approach.
Exactly.
Yeah. So is that something that you agree with?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, again, like taking love, this is just one piece of the pie, right? And it goes along with all the other pieces. And
yeah.
one big critique that scientists have with the evolutionary psychology people is that they tend to focus on hypothetical partners in their studies.
Mm-hmm.
And these partners always remain hypothetical. So I felt like in such scenarios, researchers argue that there might be pressure for heterosexual men and women to sort of confirm what's expected of them and conform
right.
to what's sort of expected of them in terms of their gendered behaviors, you
mm-hmm.
know? And there's evidence to suggest that actually the differences between men and women kind of disappear when it's real life scenario, face-to-face examples.
Interesting. How's that so?
There's this study that, study by Clark and Hatfield from 1978 to 2003, which has been replicated in recent years. They found that it was a study investigating responses to offers of casual sex. So they had a confederate, which is basically someone who works as part of the research team.
Mm-hmm.
And they're relatively same age. They went on college campuses and they had like one male and one female who were rated as attractive.
Yeah.
So their first question was whether they'd come up to a stranger, they'd tell them that, I've been looking at you, you look really attractive, would you like fancy a date with me? And they found 56% of men said yes, and 50% of women said yes to the date. The next question they asked another stranger on campus was, would you come over to my apartment? So there's the same thing, and instead of a date, would you want to come over? 69% of men said yes, and 6% of women said
major drop.
Said yes. To a big drop coming over. And then the last question they asked was whether you would have sex with me immediately off the bat. 75% of men said yes.
God.
And 0% of women said yes to sex on the first
attempt.
They replicated the study in Denmark, I think, in like 2007. Same thing. 0% of women said yes to sex. Now, if we look at these like right here, we would seem to conclude that it confirms the ideas on sex differences. You know, men are looking to spread their genetic information as quickly as they can with whoever they want. They prefer,
yeah.
you know, sex.
Right.
And women are a bit more cautious. It's an investment for them. So maybe there are some sex differences regarding receptivity to sex. But this really great researcher, Terry Conley, she redid the study and argued that women are actually perceived more negatively for engaging in the same sort of sexual behavior as men and are expected to not express their sexuality as freely.
Yeah.
She found in a series of studies that women anticipated more negative judgments from the people around them for accepting a casual sex offer.
Yeah.
And that the fear of stigmatization influenced the likelihood of acceptance.
Yeah.
And so she concluded, and I conclude as well from this, is that you can't ignore the social and historical production of responses when comparing sex differences when it comes to sex, casual sex, love. Like,
of course.
You can't just leave that out. I feel like evolutionary psychology research kind of does that sometimes.
Yeah. It's a great, like, I think, you know, we both agree that it's a great starting point.
Yeah.
But it is really, you know, we think about, like, I can think about what it would be like for me to accept an offer to, like, go over to someone's apartment and telling people about that, or knowing that this other person would tell people about
right.
that.
Yeah.
So it is, you know, there's obviously a lot more to attraction rather than just like what is like physically attractive about someone, because this is what looks like we're going to procreate well together.
Yeah.
So now that we know a little bit about attraction and like the science behind it, and again, already on a great start to understanding how complicated this is. I would love to talk a little bit about the concept of falling for someone, because this idea is so abstract and it feels so different for everyone.
Yeah.
But you have a section of this seminar dedicated to it, and I would love to understand what you kind of found about this.
Yeah,
weird
so that
thing.
That falling for someone fascinates me. It's something you find so prevalent in like literature, poetry, movies, and film, that you look at someone and you're like, there's butterflies in your stomach, you know, you're nervous around them. And these are all actually physiological responses to the idea of falling in love. Now, individuals in the early stage of intense romantic love in their brain pathways, they put a bunch of people in like MRI scans. Helen Fisher did this.
Yeah.
And they show many of the same symptoms of substance or behavioral addictions. And they include like euphoria, sense of feeling of really happy and excited to see that person, craving for that person, tolerance building for that person, and emotional and physical dependence.
Yeah.
And then in people who will come to this later, but in people who got broken up with, withdrawal and relapse. And they also found that people in these are early stage relationships. So for the falling part, there's a rush of neurochemicals in your brain associated with trust, feeling good, pair bonding, and you're basically your dopamine circuit, which is your reward center of the brain.
Yeah.
So things like oxytocin, which promotes pair bonding and trust in individuals, serotonin and dopamine, your sort of feel-good chemicals, and vasopressin. And so you feel all these neurochemical processes towards this someone, which come out as, you know, that feeling of intense joy. You're nervous, you're thinking about them all the time, you're preoccupied with thoughts about them, there's a powerful sense of empathy you feel towards them.
That's so interesting. It's just like your brain is exploding with neurochemicals, and like that is this like all-encompassing process of like starting to fall for someone. And it's so yeah, and you're so right about how so many people write about this feeling and talk about this feeling. And there's a reason for it, because it feels really freaking good.
Yeah.
Like your body's making you feel really good.
Your body makes you feel good. It's motivating you to feel that and continue to feel that, which is why people like fall so hard sometimes. You know, that's just your brain.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you mentioned Dr. Helen Fisher, which we talked a little bit about her in our Love versus Limerence. We kind of scratched the surface of the work she does. But, you know, we're both kind of brain nerds. We kind of like knowing about this stuff. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about kind of summarizing her work in your own words.
Yeah. So Helen Fisher is probably one of the most famous people who really, I think, started this looking at the brain process of love and trying to define what love means in a psychological concept. Interestingly, she's not actually a psychologist. She's like a biological anthropologist.
So
she's, you know, she says a lot of things, and I feel like it's very sciencey, which is awesome to know, but she then leaves out the other aspects of it. But that's okay. So she believes that romantic love has it's a biological drive, similar to like the sex drive, and it's not the same. So the sex drive gets you out there looking for a whole range of partners.
Okay.
But romantic love its focus, its job is to focus your mating energy on just one person at a time.
Okay.
So you conserve your energy and you start the process of pair bonding and with a single individual. You know?
Okay.
That's sort of its drive. And it's she found in her brain scan studies that the feelings of intense romantic love engaged regions of the brain's reward circuitry, specifically the dopamine-rich regions, which include the VTA, the ventral tegmental area. And this is sort of your brain's, it's part of your brain, they call it the reptilian core of the brain, the old, it's got a lot to do with motivation, impulsive behavior, that sort of stuff. And it hits that, it hits the dopamine-rich parts of your brain, which actually have a lot to do with motivation and feeling good. Mm-hmm. So she conceptualizes love as not just a feeling, but a motivation. It's making you go out and do things and do behaviors. And she found that these are the same circuits that are activated during drug addiction, specifically cocaine, like the rush of cocaine. If you look at pictures on the MRI, it's hard to distinguish because it's the exact same thing. It's the exact same regions.
That's scary. Yeah. It's so cool, but it's so scary to think that, like, this is why this, like, love and, like, heartbreak are so just powerful over the human brain.
Exactly. You know, she also found, she looked at people who were in love and then also looked at people who had recently broken up with. And she found that looking at images during the MRI of their exes, there were three specific brain regions that lit up when someone is in going through that process. So first one is the same brain region that lights up when someone is currently in love. So when you look at a picture of your ex, you're still lighting up the same dopamine-rich areas, which would be in the love part. So you're still thinking about them. It's still all there. Your neurochemistry is still firing off. The second brain region that becomes activated in people experiencing a breakup is one associated with calculating gains and losses. And so she says that helps explain to us why we like overanalyze like every little thing. Did I do this right? Did I say something wrong? What if I did this?
Oh,
so that part lights up. And then the final part is the brain region associated with deep attachment to another individual that becomes active in people who've been broken up with. But this is like, these are big things in the brain. It's not, it's like you don't necessarily have control over what fires up and what doesn't. And this is part of the reason why for some people breakups can be really, really difficult, you know?
Yeah. And we talked a lot about, well, we talked a little bit, like I said, about Helen Fisher and like this idea of limerence versus love and like what is obsession and what is true, like love and attachment, which, you know, science can't really distinguish those things, because when you really look at the science, it is like you said, it's like you become addicted to someone, like you have become just utterly obsessed with them, and like the fact that you can break up with someone and those same circuitry can light up when you see a picture of them, that just shows how this concept of what love is first incredibly intense and like really makes the brain react intensely and high functioning, but also leaves a lasting impression on folks.
Exactly.
And that's why, like, you know, going back to the beginning of this conversation, this must have been a fantastic, well, it's an interesting thing to learn, but like, it's kind of fantastic. You're like, okay, so I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
Like, this is, I feel like when I learned about this for the first time, I was like, okay, I'm allowed to feel this way. This is how I'm actually like programmed to think in a way.
I think you hit it right on the spot there when you feel like you're not going mad. You're not going crazy. You're not just sitting there and like, you know, feeling all these things, being able to go and see people do research and find like, oh, it's my brain. It's my brain. It's not just me, man. It's
my
brain.
Like,
I'm allowed to do this. I don't have control over it. And then like, it still sucks. You still feel like, you know, it still sucks, but you can conceptualize it and you're like, okay, like I understand it now.
Yeah.
I'll let myself do this, go through this process.
Yeah. Well, that was a great breakdown. I hope everyone found this as fascinating as I did. I know that we talked a lot about some brainy things, but I really think that helps conceptualize what, you know, we can conceive of our brain neurochemistry in our own feelings and thoughts on it. But it's kind of nice to know that everyone's in the same boat. We're all doing this.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break to listen to some PSAs. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about our own experience using psychological research and maybe some issues with the psychology of love. We will be right back.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre, the SASC, is a free and confidential service which provides support to those who experience sexual assault, intimate partner violence, and harassment. We provide services to folks of all genders, including students, staff, faculty, and those who have a connection to the UBC Vancouver campus. We provide crisis and short-term emotional support, legal, medical, and campus-related advocacy, and outreach and educational programs. We are located in the Student Nest, room 3130. For more information on our hours of operation and other resources and services, please go to our website, amssasc.ca, or visit our Facebook page, AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre.
And we're back. You're listening to Therapy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM. We're talking about the psychology of love. We had a really brainy little section there for all of you, but we're going to debrief, let your brains rest a little bit. And we're going to just kind of talk about us now. You know, we've been talking about how love is this like beautiful and complicated and abstract feeling that has like some science, but kind of also not. And it almost feels really silly to even like, you know, I made you do a little exercise where I forced you to define the this term love. But I'm really interested as someone who's done like this much research and this much like digging into the psychology of love. Do you really think that we'll be able to like, I guess, definitively and scientifically pin down what this crazy feeling is?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think in psychology, we're always looking for ways to pin down what a thing is, and then we find out that there is no way to actually do that,
which
is kind of frustrating at times.
Yeah.
But see, like, someone asked me this when I first came up with the idea of this course. They said, it's great and all that you're going to go and try to understand it and try to bring it out and conceptualize it, write it down, and you know, leave with a sort of logical understanding of love. But love sometimes is not logical. Love is sometimes crazy and weird, and you don't understand it. And they asked me if I feel like if I go through this process, will I lose some of the magic that comes and the mystery that comes with not understanding what something is, not understanding what love is, you know? Yeah. It adds to that. And I say, well, no, because you can understand something and it's still going to be beautiful.
Yeah.
And I don't think we are going to come to a place where we can pin down what love is in one clean, nice few sentences.
No.
I think if you talk to people in the field, they come from different perspectives. You have your evolutionary biology perspective. You have your brain circuitry perspective. But then you have people who will take on the social aspect of it. I think it's way too complex of an emotion, of a feeling that we can pin down in words. But I think we can take some really great steps into understanding it better and be able to then sort of learn how to love better and learn how to like do that better amongst our friends, our families, our partners. And I think that's where the great understanding will be. I don't think we'll be able to pin down what love means. But I think we'll be able to love better.
Yeah.
My understanding.
Yeah, because I feel like with, you know, with psychology and a lot of different scientific research, really what we're doing, at least in a Western context, is we're trying to find patterns and we're just trying to understand what people are doing usually at a specific time for a specific thing.
Yeah.
And I think a common misconception is kind of knowing this definition and having like a truth to tell. And like, that's kind of what is beautiful about the different aspects of psychology. You have fantastic and smart, smart people who are, for the most part, arguing like all the time because everybody wants to be right and everybody wants to like pin something down.
Yeah.
And in a way, at least to me, like that's really amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, we have this dedication as humans to really figure out, mm-hmm. like, what's going on with us. And I love what you said, that this research can really help us learn to love better. And also, like, and I hope, you know, lots of people will get this, and we'll talk more about maybe what we can learn from this podcast or this specific episode, is that people can understand that these feelings are normal, mm-hmm. in a way. Like, that's kind of what we were saying, is like, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about you explaining this, like, love as an addiction thing, and I'm like, thank God other people think this way. Thank God someone's being paid like a big amount to tell me that it's actually fine that I feel this way. I think that I want to just like shoot that question back. Like, do you think this makes a difference to understand how relationships, love, falling in love, attraction, do you think that makes, you were kind of talking about it earlier, but like, in what ways, like, you find that it makes a difference in your life now, maybe, versus when you didn't know these types of things?
Yeah, so I think it does make a difference in the sense that I feel a lot more informed now about my own self and what happens to me when I'm attracted to someone else, or I have feelings for someone else. And I'm a bit more like, I'm like, oh, I'm going through this. Oh, I'm feeling this for someone. What sort of chemicals are going through my brain? And as much as you try to understand it, you're still going to fall into love's trap. Like, love is still going to get you. You know? Still, you're still going to, you know, be unable to pinpoint why all the time or something like that. But I think it just helps me be more informed. And then I'm able to go through the process next time slightly more like comfortable and sort of like letting it happen to me, and now I'm like not as uncomfortable or scared as to what is this feeling I'm feeling, because now I can answer it. I'm feeling love. Like, this is what's going on in my head. This is what's going on in my brain. This is what's going on, you know. And through that, just having knowledge about it, I think, is empowering. And then through that, you can then love better, or learn to love better, learn to be better in a relationship, learn to understand people better.
Yeah.
That's what the best thing that comes out of it, I think.
Yeah, I love what you said about how, you know, having this information doesn't mean that you're going to like go out in the world and be like, okay, so I'm going to seek out somebody who smells very opposite to what I think I would need, and that I'm going to like find someone that lives really close to me, like, and I'm gonna go and my make connections checklist.
Exactly. I'm gonna find someone who ticks all these boxes, and then I should fall in love.
Then you're gonna fall in love, and it's gonna be actually perfect. Like, that's not really how these things work. I think the observation of humans is so important, and like to look around you and view the way that other people tend to like be in relationships versus yourself. And also, like, you know, taking back to what you said earlier on in this episode, how this kind of prompts you to just start talking to people. Like, mm-hmm. I find that when I learn something new, especially in psych, and it has to do with some form of human relation, like, I love talking to other people about it. And in that, even you learn more about the people around you and how someone else fell in love and how they dealt with those feelings. Yeah. And that like knowledge, and I hope that the listeners today can like take this knowledge, and maybe you do go and talk to someone about this, and just in that interaction can really benefit your understanding of what you want to do the next time you're into someone, or if you're coping with some form of breakup and you're able to like talk to people more. Like, that's always what I want from this podcast.
I think like one of the goals I have for this course is that I'm doing this so that I can then have people come and talk about their stories of love, because everyone does. It's something that, you know, touches everyone, I feel, at some point in their lives. Like, love is such a fundamentally human thing that everyone has something to say. Everyone has an opinion on it. And I think that's beautiful, because that will just add to the repository of information on our definition of love. Like, we keep adding to it. And that's sort of what you want as someone who wants to research a topic. Like, yes, I've had my experiences with it, and here's what the literature says. But then I also want to invite you to tell me, what do you think about love? How have you felt? What goes through, what kind of feelings do you feel? How do you take it? You know, I think that that contributes to knowledge, and that's what building knowledge is all about.
Nice. Well, yeah, that actually leads me to my other question. And this is something that we don't always get to talk about that much on Therapy Hour, but I do think it's really important. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, like, with all this work that you've done and kind of scanning through all these articles, what's an area of research, of the research of love, that you think needs more exploration and maybe needs more of that, like, invitation for people to, you know, contribute more to the research?
One thing that, something that's close to heart is, like, I think we've mentioned this on the podcast before, how a lot of psych research is very Western, and, you know, it hits a lot of educated people, college campuses. A lot of the research I've cited today is to do what with Western notions of love and sex. And thing is, like, we have to understand it doesn't look the same for other people and other cultures. And a lot of this research that I've cited, I think, is also very heteronormative. And we have to keep that into account, that there is a whole bunch of other people, other populations who exist, who also have something to feel about love and say something about love. And I think we can do a better job in psychology of trying to bring those voices more into the mainstream. And part of our course is trying to have a section devoted to cross-cultural perspectives on love and definitions of love, because it can look different for, you know, different cultures. That's one thing that I think I want to focus more on. And then I want psychology to focus more on. Because it's such a universal thing. But it's cool how we, in psychology, we can take things and we see them as universal, like behaviors, but then we look into the research and sample sizes and all that and realize, oh, like, it's college kids, or it's just like, it's just white Western college kids who are doing the study. So how do we apply this to everyone else? So I think just branching out and trying to really get at the heart of love in different cultures, different countries, different, you know, sexual orientations.
And I think the other thing I was going to add too is, you know, obviously we talk a lot about how psych is just really not cross-cultural in a lot of ways, at least not the big, you know, well-funded psych projects. But also I find that, you know, in searching for what love is for other people and for other cultures and other sexualities and other gender expressions, like, those definitions are going to start to change. Like, you may ask someone from a completely different culture questions that you've been asking Western people, and you won't get the same answers, and maybe you won't even get the same understanding. Like, I think that, you know, when we talk about relationships, connection, especially when you start looking at, like, marriages and how relationships function, the definitions of what love really start to change. I had this really interesting conversation with my mom where we talked a lot about how in some places, and especially in some aspects for her, love and marriage was really kind of just this expectation. And maybe in some respects you do it because it, yes, maybe you like this person, but it may also just benefit you. And that's a fascinating aspect of relationships that I don't find really gets researched that often. And Western cultures do tend to look down upon, when in reality, like, we can't really say that that's not something that Western cultures are looking at as well. Like, you talked about this, like, reciprocity thing where it's like you need to see that someone is able to give you something to even be attracted to them. And if we could redefine that and like start to think about that, like, push it more to the front, we could have this better concept of, like, utility in relationships. And I think that's something that could be very important in a lot of ways.
That's fascinating. There are, I think in high school there was one thing I learned about when we were looking at relationship formation in different cultures, and it was found that, like, for me, I'm South Asian. So South Asian cultures, in marriage, typically on average, you don't marry out of love. You marry out of convenience or family ties or raising kids. Like, the goal, the conceptualization is different. Like, they might not place love as that important. You know, it doesn't mean that part, like, those couples aren't in love or don't have successful, healthy marriages. But I think in the West, they would say you marry, you fall in love and then you get married, versus I think there's a saying that goes that you marry and then you fall in love. It's a whole different conceptualization of what love means, and that's amazing. That's,
that's well, they've done a little bit of research. I remember in one of my classes, they talked about a study that they did on relationship success in chosen marriages and arranged marriages. And arranged marriages had a significantly higher success rate. And whether I think whether that you can conceive of that as both ways, but like yeah. even Western research can show that. And I just find it fascinating. And I think that with this type of research, and I think that it's great that the course that you're doing is going to be a seminar. And I'm really looking forward to, you know, what that will bring out of like yeah. those students. Like, I think that so many people want to talk about love and they have so many things to talk about in that. Very exciting. Yeah,
excited to have it go through.
Yeah. And if you are listening and you, I think you probably have to be a psych student to take this seminar.
Actually, no, you don't. You do have to, you do have to write like maybe like 100, 200 words. And don't catch me on this. It might change.
But okay.
You'll have to give a sort of rationale as to like why you want to do it and what you might contribute.
Okay.
Because there's a cap on the number of people. But yeah, I mean, you don't have to be a psych major. It's an upper level arts course. It'll be offered in term two, so next year. So
starting January 2023.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So if anybody wants to go and take that course, I highly recommend it. I've read through the syllabus and everything. It looks fantastic. You'll even maybe see, we've talked a little bit about some articles I might send you.
Yeah.
So you'll have a piece of therapy hour there as well, maybe. But that kind of concludes our episode today. We do have a little bit of homework with you, which Ryan very graciously gave us. So this week we'll be asking you to ask yourself what the definition of love is for you. So whether that means you are on a walk and you want to think about it, or if you want to sit down and write it out, and if that brings out any reflection, it'd be nice, I think, in this. Well, this is kind of what I'm thinking of doing, is that I want to write it down somewhere and then revisit after a little bit. And like just see how that changes, and maybe even talk to your friends and see how they define love.
Yeah.
Because it can all be very different.
Yeah. It will be some fascinating conversation.
Yeah. And if you want to send us your responses, which you don't have to, but we'd love hearing from you on the Therapy Hour podcast, you can DM us at Therapy Hour Pod on Instagram. This has been your free therapy session for this week. We're your hosts. I'm Halle.
And I'm Ryan. This is Therapy Hour, because everybody needs therapy.
But not everyone can afford it. Thank you so much, Ryan, for taking the time to speak with me. Tune in next week for a surprise episode. Mostly because Violet and I don't really know what we're going to talk about next week. If any of our listeners have any suggestions, I strongly urge you to DM us. Again, Therapy Hour Pod on Instagram. See you next week. Bye-bye for now.